Hello, you're listening to a podcast recorded live at the 2017 Sydney Writers' Festival.
Hello and welcome. It's my pleasure to invite you all here today to join with us in talking and thinking about the work of Australian author Helen Garner. My name's Rebecca Giggs. I'm an author from Sydney. It's our privilege to be here talking to you today on country belonging to the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. This is country that has been nourished by story, by traditional culture, for many thousands of years, and we pay our heartfelt respects to those peoples today. But we are gathered here today following the response of a biography slash critical edition about Helen Garner's work and life, and that is this book here, A Writing Life, written by Bernadette Brennan. So to my right is the author, Bernadette. Thank you, Ben. Bernadette was permitted access to Helen Garner's archives in the National Library for the purposes of writing this book, including letters, journals, early drafts of novels, an extraordinary trove of information. And the book, I think, documents through Garner's work also the creative communities that she moved in, the cities that she had attachments to, and the people that figured in her creative life. It would be impolite, if not impolitic, to talk about a writer's legacy while they're still living. But we have a number of other authors on the stage who've joined us to think about the significance and the reverberations of Helen Garner's work in their writing lives and in their thinking. So next to Bernadette, we have Annabelle Crabb. Annabelle, of course, many know from ABC TV, if not from her very popular columns in the Fairfax newspapers, The Herald and The Age, from her podcasts, from her books. Annabelle is a very trusted voice in Australian media. She's a sharp and, I think, often very funny commentator on public life and culture in Australia. Then we have Jennifer Byrne as well. Jennifer Byrne, who passionate readers will know, of course, from the ABC book club show. She's one of Australia's most astute readers. Welcome, Jennifer Byrne. And Ben Law, of course. Ben's most... already there are fans. Already there are fans in the audience. So my friend Ben Law, whose work, The Family Law, his first book has been made into a major adaptation for SBS TV. Many of you will have seen it, I'm sure. Ben is also often published in the Fairfax newspapers. He's a wonderful mentor as well for a number of younger writers, which is a role I think that kind of goes often unacknowledged in these spaces. So these are our guests here today to join with us in talking and thinking about Helen Garner's work. I think I'll start with talking to Bernadette a little bit about this publication, given that she's spent this long swathe of time in close focus with Helen Garner's publications. So, Bernadette, any number of Australian authors would have loved the opportunity to dig into writing a biography of Garner. Can you tell us a little bit about how this book came about, what was its inception, and the process of writing it?
Yes, for sure. It's an interesting thing you say, so many Australian writers would like to do that, because I've been told that by a number of writers and colleagues and readers since I've published this book. And I think, why didn't you do it? So why did this book come about? Well, Helen Garner is an extremely important and popular and controversial writer, Australian writer. She's now 74. She's been publishing for 40 years. It got to the point where I thought, there is no one book that has brought together her 40 years of writing and looked at this writer's work as an organic whole. And I think I'm the person to do it. And I'd actually kind of avoided doing it for a while because I wasn't sure that I wanted to go towards the first stone material. I was a bit nervous of, as a female academic, I'd been part of the kind of vitriolic attacks and fights that were going on. But once I heard there was this, or once I discovered there was this archival material in the National Library, it just looked like gold. And I thought, this is the time to write this book. So I wrote to Helen and said, look, can I have a look at those embargoed files? And as I've said before in some interviews, she said to me, oh, look, I don't remember what's in them. I did it for a tax reason at the beginning and I'm a bit nervous about what's in them. And she said, are other authors as nervous as that? And I said, I don't know. I haven't asked them. But she said, look, I think you're on a roll, so maybe we should talk about it. So I went to Melbourne and we had a long 4 or 5 hour discussion. She said, yes, I'm giving you access to everything. So there I was. I had access to Helen, who was open to this project, and I had access to this extraordinary wealth of material that she had worked on and written in her diaries and her process journals from the time of Cosmo Cosmolino until now. Some of it wasn't yet archived because she was still writing the books while I started this. And then she was open to something being written. She was not open to a biography, and I perfectly respected that. Although we might talk about that, whether it is a biography, because I would argue that in a sense it actually is. It's actually pushing some boundaries the way she likes to push boundaries. Mm-hmm. But I thought I won't be delving into really private things of this living writer who has a daughter and grandchildren and partners and sisters and other people living at the moment, but I will give enough context to understand her work, which is, I think, what I've done and what I've been told by readers I've done. So... Mm. Is that an answer to your question?
Absolutely.
I can't remember. I could go on all day.
It's interesting, that question of genre with this work as a sort of... well, perhaps one way to unpack that for those who haven't yet had a chance to read the book, buy the book afterwards, please, is to think about the structure of it. Because, you know, Helen Garner is a writer who has written screenplays, novels, non-fiction books, essays. This is a woman who moves, you know, hops through multiple genres. And you decided to structure the book chronologically in the end.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that decision?
Yes, because I didn't want to structure the book chronologically. I had two things in my mind at the beginning. I had no idea what shape the book would take, and I used to call it a beast. I don't know what kind of beast this will be. Michael Hayward said he wanted to publish it. I said, I don't know what I will produce, because I had to deal with Helen's life. And yet I wanted to deal with her work. How was I going to find the right voice? How was I going to find the right genre? Could I do a half-baked biography and say, oh, you didn't tell us about all these things we need to know? Or I didn't want to do a scholarly monograph, because that's not true to the way Helen writes. Helen writes in a way that's deeply intelligent and structured, but it's to appeal to writers who understand what she's saying. So I had to do that. So I thought, well, what do I do here? And I also thought, this is a woman who has deliberately transgressed official or set boundaries of genre for 40 years to test the limits of what language and writing can do. The least I can do is try and do something the same. Not try and copy her, but at least do something new. So I came up with this idea of a literary portrait, that the spine of the... why is it chronological? Because Helen Garner writes to and of her time. And so there'll be readers here who read Monkey Grip when it was first published. And if the lights weren't so bright and I could see their eyes, they would probably sparkle and say, oh, Monkey Grip, there was nothing like it. So what she was writing was so much of her time, culturally, politically, socially, that it didn't make sense to then say, okay, what I'll do is I'll write about the bedrooms in Helen Garner's books, or I'll write about courtrooms or something. It had to be in terms of the social, political, cultural milieu of what she was doing and what was happening in her life. Mm. And so that actually ended up making it quite easy, because there's a thread through the book of Helen's life. You know, what's happening when she's 35? What's happening when she's 50? What happens when that book gets published and she spirals downwards or whatever? Mm. So that's how I structured it.
Yes, I wonder about that question of reading the books at the time they were released and then reading them retrospectively afterwards. I think many of us who encountered Monkey Grip, you know, many decades after it was published, have a different relationship to that book as well. Did your relationship to Garner's work change over the course of writing this book?
It did. I think I started this book, I was not the gushy fan of Helen Garner. I thought she was a fine writer and a very interesting and nice woman, as much as I knew her at the time. And I think that was a good starting point. I didn't want to be some gushy, oh, I love Helen Garner, I must, you know, do this. Being a literary academic, I had this beautiful fallback position, because what you do when you go to write about a writer is you go to their published texts and you immerse yourself in them, and it's a delight and it's frustrating and it's all those sorts of things, but you deeply, deeply read those texts and think about them. So that's what I did, and that was the way that I just thought, well, this is the way into the work and you know, what I can do with it. And so as I analysed them more, as I got to know her more, as I understood what was happening in her life more, which is why she wrote that book that way at that time, I just developed a deeper and deeper respect for her writing, for her talent, for her craft. But I have to say, over the 2 years of working closely with her, a deep respect for her as a human being. Mm. A very, very deep respect. She's an extraordinary woman.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I might open that to our other guests as well, thinking about how your relationship to Ghana has changed over time. Are there particular books that have, you know, you've read and then reread and come back to and thought differently?
The First Stone, for sure.
The First Stone,
yeah. I would love to hear more about your awkward relationship with The First Stone. I mean, I'm happy to talk about mine, but just when it came out, where did you stand in the spectrum of responses to that book?
Ah, well, I was one of the minority in my academic world. I was not as enraged as a lot of my colleagues were. I have colleagues who said they will never teach Ghana again, they'll never read Ghana again. I wasn't of that ilk. I did think she's done what she always does. She's put herself out there. She's said quite honestly where she's going with the book. So I didn't take that kind of offence. Now, rereading it over the years, I've gone from, you know, that position to fury, back to another position.
Yeah.
And in fact, when I was writing my chapter on The First Stone, I sent her a text one day. It happened to be her birthday. And I sent her a text saying, ah, you're killing me.
Yeah.
So I've changed my position about six times this afternoon. And she sent one straight back and said, ha ha, that's what it was like when I was writing it.
Yeah. But that's the thing about her. You know, you can... She leaves it open while she writes. She exposes herself to feeling the maximum confusion and desolation and temporary elation and then crashing again, and that tends to pursue her through the pages of the book that she's writing. And I remember when The First Stone was published and I was a sort of angry campus feminist about it and, you know... you know, outraged. Absolutely. Yes. She doesn't get it, you know. And it was a classic sort of clash of feminisms moment, I suppose. Mm-hmm. You know, these older feminists, you know, they don't understand. And I denounced it, you know, at the time. And then I think probably about 10 or 15 years later, I went, sort of crept back and read it again and developed this, I think, respect for the extent to which writing that book cost her personally. And I think that is one, probably the thing that I most respect about her as a writer. She never shies away from difficulty, from personal pain. You can see her just sort of getting up and writing out again every morning, even though she's deep in the shit, you know, and that's an extraordinary characteristic. And I have changed my mind about that book quite considerably since I first read it.
Jen, what do you remember about that release?
It's interesting because I knew Annabelle would say that because the thing, because we're both journalists, and the journalist in one is just completely, it's both heretical in that it was one of the first books, you know, where she is a character herself, which in journalism is kind of a no-no, you don't do that, you're the observer. It was transgressive, the fight that was going on was amazing. I'm a Ghana person by, as you said, she writes for time. It was my time. She's a bit older than me, but, you know, I went through school and stuff quite fast, so... I come from her place. I'm a Melbourne-born girl, and I was living in Melbourne when Monkey Grip came out. So, I mean, I have a very, very strong connector with her, both as a... I remember Digger magazine, where she famously wrote the article as X, where she talked about sex bluntly. I mean, I remember all that scandal. One of my men, you know, I used to go out with Michael Gawendo, he was part of that collective. So I was the younger person hanging around the edges of her life, not her life physically, but that world in Monkey Grip. And then there were the other ones, and to be quite frank, that wasn't of much interest to me. And then she came out with this, which, and I, of course, had been to Melbourne University, and it just, split the city, it split the sisterhood. I loved her for that. Loved her. Because if anything the Melbourne bloody establishment needed, it was splitting up. They'd be marrying each other forever. It made me furious. Exactly like Annabelle. I mean, I was outraged. I hated the fact she was inside the book, but that was what made it so powerful. I argued with myself for years and years and years. I did what, of course, you know, you do, because by that time I think I'd moved into publishing, and I went and found a woman now better known as Virginia Trioli, who was then called Virginia Trioli, but not so well known. She was on Melbourne Radio and commissioned a book, which was the F word, which was basically the young feminist's riposte to Ghana, because that was the fun of it. And I was reading that chapter this morning again, Bernadette, and it all came back to me. The rage and the joy and the excitement. And she is amazing, because she is not just an author. She's not just a journalist. She's not just a rogue teacher who shook everybody down and said, why can't we do this? Why can't we be honest with our students? She's just a phenomenal woman.
But that chapter too, sorry, Ben, we're just going to completely talk over you. Please. Later on, we're going to talk about childbirth.
I'm used to it from my mum.
Look, the chapter in this book, if you haven't read it, that details the whole First Stone episode, it's like a detective novel. I mean, I had an elevated pulse just reading it because of all this stuff that was happening behind the scenes, which you set out. It's just an invaluable piece of context, and I never knew all that stuff about what was going on and the structuring of the book and how to deal with various people. And it was, it's messy. It's messy, and at times you just absolutely clench everything for Ghana, because it is a mess and she makes some terrible errors. But the context, to soak that in, to be aware of it, is just such a rich reading experience.
And also, what you admire is when you remember those shocking errors, which include she wrote this support of a letter of support on the day one.
And I think
to the master,
which he then photocopied,
and stuck everywhere
for the alleged the perpetrator of this abuse. And it was the fact that she went through that, she battled through that, and came up with this enormously conflictual and troubled and riveting book.
Yeah, for me it's kind of like a book where you show you're working out, right? It's like your process. And I remember actually The First Stone was the first book that I read of hers, because I was at the Lifeline Book Fest, this kind of malformed 17-year-old who thought that he wanted to be a writer, and it's like, what should I read? What am I supposed to read? Helen Garner is someone I'm supposed to read. So I picked up The First Stone and didn't have this whole background context in terms of the fights around it and all that sort of stuff, but I knew that she was one of the authors I should be reading. And at that time, I had this kind of huge allergy to the idea of Australian writing in general. Like, for me, Australian writing, and I'm double the age now, so, I've learnt better. But for me, at that stage, Australian writing was always very male, and it was always about the bush, and I can only stand so many accounts of sheep shearing. And but here was this voice that was very urban, dealing with those kind of city problems that we deal with, issues of sex and friendship and relationships. And then when I read it, because it was really instructive as me as a writer to kind of, the fact that she owns up and writes about a huge cock-up in the very first instance, the fact that she wrote her letter and showed her cards to the reader, she's like scrambling backwards for the rest of that book trying to correct this. She has no access to those two women. And as a writer, when you pursue a story in nonfiction, you are sometimes limited, and sometimes that's because of your own fault as well. And the fact that she just throws that in there in the very first few pages, I think, I just thought, wow, I feel like I'm about to read a disaster, and how do you get around that? And for me, the story, as much as the story is compelling and as much as the politics around it are also compelling, as a writer, I thought it was really, really a great thing for someone to own up to your mistakes, to own up to your limitations, and also to be really aware of your prejudices, because as much as in the field of journalism, you're always striving towards this idea of objectivity, it's also an industry of value judgments as well. What should be even written about in the first place? That's informed by your personal prejudices, and the outcome is also informed by your cock-ups.
But that's, of course, why journalists are so opposed to it, because one knows that. You know you are carrying around your prejudices and you are desperately trying not to have it influence your writing, but you know at some level it does, and that was why it was so powerful,
but
wasn't it?
But isn't it interesting that in the later part of her life, Helen Garner became so interested in the work of Janet Malcolm, who is, you know, the authority on the fallibility of journalists, you know, and Helen does in her work show her working. That's a really great way of putting it. But she's almost compulsively coughing up all of these disclosures about her own issues and her own prejudices, almost as if to set them out, not to be accused of harbouring them in secret.
Well, in the first Stone, I think particularly, like, it wasn't just that she had put herself into the narrative and that she'd, hadn't used his real name, had called him Shepherd, which I think was a Colin Shepherd, which is a name with, particular kinds of moralistic attachments to it, but also that she'd created, she'd split characters, hadn't she? She'd split two characters into six, is that right?
Jenna Mead was the antagonist in the story.
Yeah.
And she, through, as I detail through this, the legals that they got, the advice was that she had to split, she could not name her.
Yep.
And it was Hilary McPhee that convinced Helen that you are going to have to make some change and you are going to have to split this character up. And she did very, very unhappily, and
was later heavily criticised.
It was a disaster.
Yeah, for creating an impression that there was a gang of people who were aligned against her, as opposed to
And through one of the beauties of this archive is that all the interviews are there and everything, all the transcriptions are there. So, and in it was this plus the next two non-fiction books, the amount of material she discovers is extraordinary, but it doesn't go into the book. And so, yes, she got attacked for that, and that was the whole idea of breaking the contract with the reader. This is non-fiction. You don't do that.
Well, yeah, and but I think she never quite shook off that suspicion.
She did not.
Like, I'm in this House of Grief, I had a good friend call me and say, Louise, who's a young 16-year-old woman in that book who acts as a kind of interlocutor with Helen, my friend Sam ran me and said, oh, Louise isn't real, is she? Louise has been made up for this book. And we sort of both hesitated and said, well, maybe if she's not, we're okay with that. It's Garner. It's like, you know, maybe this fictionalisation. Yeah. Of course, as it turns out, Louise is real and is in fact as smart as 16-year-old.
Did say those things. Yeah. I can guarantee that one.
That account of the backwards and forwards and the legal advice and the slicing and dicing of this controversial character into six bits or whatever just made me almost feel like throwing up, because I just, like, you get to that stage and you've written a book and suddenly lawyers are, all you want to do is lie down and sleep forever and never see any of it again. And the wear and tear of just, you know, having to revisit it and then have all this sort of upheaval among your friendships and your publisher, like, I just thought, how is this woman even still on her feet, you know? And then to have it published and then that be the beginning of the controversy is just...
Where she then spiralled.
Yeah.
I mean, the point about the controversy is, I think it's just worth... And many of you will remember, but not everyone will remember. Beyond the book, these were the divisions in the feminist movement at the time. I mean, her criticism of Jenna Mead, you know, whatever form she took, it was exactly the sort of dialogue and argumentation that was going on between the newer feminists who were saying, you know, basically there is no line, cross the line, you've got to be held up and treated almost like in a domestic violence cut, you know, you cannot cross that line at all. The older feminists, of which, I mean, I was more in the Garner camp, we were always told, roll with it, you know, call out the big thing, but, you know, don't... That's, and her use of words that she did against Shepherd, which was she defended him, but she'd attacked the women as punishing. And this was, I think it's really important to remember, this wasn't just a story about a case involving a university dean. This was the discussion that was going on all around Australia at the time First Stone came out.
And America. It was huge. Oleana was in New York when she's sitting in New York writing it. So, and I quote Frank Rich in the New York Times saying something like, Mamet has picked the scab off one of the great wounds of current time or whatever. He did it more elegantly than that. So every and there was the Anita Hill and the Clarence Thomas investigations going on. So she leaves Australia, taking her five journals with her, goes to a small apartment in New York for 3 months to write it, and there she encounters the world going mad, if you like, in terms of newspapers and what's going on at Broadway of sexual harassment and the...
It's what we fought about before we fought about identity politics, yeah. Isn't it? Yeah. It just seems so quaint now.
Well, I don't know. I don't know that it's changed that much. I think
there was a great opportunity to write a piece bringing together the Rolling Stone controversy over the reporting of sexual assault on campus with the Helen Garner First Stone book. I was waiting for that.
I had this book that is published. Look at it. This is 30,000 words less than it was to begin with, and that was in there. I kept all that. I was following that at the
another
time.
Another essay then.
So there's an awful lot of essays that have been cut
and
out.
This was, I think, right. And this was all at the time that Helen Garner was writing and won a Walkley Award for her reporting on the Daniel Valerio case, which many of you know was the enormous child abuse case that... and it was like this boy had months and so much abuse, and it was a horrific case. She wrote a magnificent piece, and she even then controversially she said, you know, that's why domestic violence is a thing of its own, and feminism, we've all got to be a bit more, you know, calibrated, we can't. And it was just, she was such a lightning rod for discussions, and that was what was so exciting whenever she picked up a pen. Yeah.
Ben, her persona in nonfiction, the way that she characterises herself, just kind of moving on from the First Stone to look at some of the more recent books. Mm. Tell me about your impressions of Garner as a character in nonfiction.
Okay, so, you know, like everyone has their idea of what a perfect essay is, and for a lot of us it's like Joan Didion's On Keeping a Notebook, for instance. I remember, like, with her latest collection, Everywhere I Look, reading that piece in the Monthly called The Insults of Age. Now, whenever I do a creative writing class, you know, they ask for readings, and it's one that I provide because I think it's the perfect piece, and it goes down a hit as well. You know, like, everyone... I don't think it matters what your age is. You can relate to it in some way, shape or form. And when I read it, what I realised was that the words cantankerous and crotchety are used as pejoratives when really they're kind of awesome, powerful things to be, you know.
And kind she of loves made, being them.
Well, it kind of made me look forward to being cantankerous and crotchety as well. And, you know, there's that kind of sequence where she's strolling down maybe Swanson Street or something, and she sees this girl just being absolutely hideous to the older women in her orbit, in her immediate path. And, you know, it's kind of this form of, you know, physical confrontation and violation as well. When someone's kind of in your space, and the subtext is that it's mocking you for your inability to fight back as well, because one, of maybe your age, and two, you can't do that as well. And the fact that Helen Garner... I just want to read a bit because it's so satisfying. I remember reading it for the first time and I wanted to high-five her or something like that, where... you know,
she was high-fiving herself, I think. She was so proud of it.
I imagine so. Like she says, in two strides, I was behind the schoolgirl. I reached up, seized her ponytail at the roots and gave it a sharp, downward yank. Her head snapped back, and in a voice I didn't recognise... I love that. In a voice I didn't recognise, I snarled, "Give it a rest, darling." That is so delicious. And then she twisted to look behind. Her eyes were bulging, her mouth agape. I let go and she bolted away to her friends. And the three of them set off at a run. And then the whole thing is that she does this so quickly that she barely realises that she's done it herself. And she was walking alongside a friend who didn't even realise she was out of stride as well. And I just think that just shows such great, you know, such great strength, but also, of course, physical agility. That I don't know. It's just one of those perfect pieces where, you know, that kind of, I don't know, like some people might read that and think, wow, that's a really mean thing to do, but
one of
I
her
just
friends says,
awesome.
So you just assaulted this schoolgirl.
Yeah.
And but she puts that in too, so it's a bit like the letter to the master.
Yeah.
People might
first stony, you know,
after a few people had suggested, and the lawyers had suggested I had just done common assault, committed common assault, you know, and then she puts in the granddaughter, suggesting to me, perhaps you could have spoken to her and not assaulted this young girl. But she puts it in there and then says, no way, I'm going to go for
That's what I like. I think that her pieces are always strewn with self-doubt.
Yeah.
And I think that's really, really important whenever you're writing about something that's complicated. And I think, you know, I'm trying to write this piece at the moment where... you know, it's about a news story where everyone is sort of set in their certainty. And that's like most news stories nowadays. You know, even if you're reading what's supposed to be the daily news, objective facts, and ostensibly they are, but you can kind of read behind everything that everyone set up a battle line in this culture war. And those discussions aren't very interesting after everyone's taken a side as well. And you can't really move beyond it. And what she does is kind of like, doesn't throw grenades out to the reader, but kind of throws them against herself. As well, like
I do wonder
this. That said, this.
Yeah,
constant caveats.
I do wonder whether she does that to ventriloquize her readers' responses to her positions.
Sometimes like anticipating. Them.
Yeah, sometimes I wonder whether we're actually seeing an account of her inner life, or if we're seeing her anticipations
of potential readership.
Yeah,
or her invitation to the readers. Her idea to make the text. She says she wants to make the text porous. So everything is about how do I open this up to my readers so we all read it and say, oh, we get that, or we respond, or you think, oh, that's so good. Because she hasn't set up a position, she's opened it up. It's like these nonfiction works she writes, and she crafts this kind of naive voice, you know, didn't it? You know, she's in court, didn't it say duty of care? I would have thought it did, or this sort of stuff. By the time she's written that, she's studied all the legal textbooks. She's written 18 drafts of Jo Cinque. She knows exactly her position, but she recreates a kind of an openness and a naivety that says to the reader, come on in, let's...
Do you think that's... I mean, I can see that becomes a device of writing, but I can't help, possibly because I'm, you know, incredibly gullible and also totally in love with her, that I...
it's good you didn't write the book.
It's great that you did it. It just would have been, oh, my God, spittle-flecked if I'd done it. but the thing that I... just treasure in her as a writer is that there is this porousness. I feel like she never, ever closes herself off to anxiety or self-doubt, or I think she lies awake worrying about this stuff. And imagine if you were so accomplished and so successful and, you know, a lesser person, I think, would rest on their laurels a bit and believe the bullshit about themselves, right? But I feel like she worries that she's underqualified to understand this stuff. I think she reads all of the background legal texts and worries about this sort of ins and outs of the cat's ass point of law, because she wants to close off every possible angle and have thought about everything. And that includes leaving herself open to constant anxiety about whether she's chosen the right approach, or, you know, I haven't spoken to this person, does it matter? Can I keep working on this book where I can't talk to this person? Which seems to just go on happening to her.
And yet she's not a very relativist writer. Like, she is interested in the big ideas of morality and good and evil, and she's very declarative, actually, despite this... sort of anxious turn.
That I think, if you want to say, what I find the most interesting thing about Helen is that she is frighteningly intelligent, incredibly quick with her judgments and her ideas, and knows that she's really good and is terribly hurt by negative criticism, whatever. She knows how good she is, but is riven with self-doubt, absolutely riven with it, and still thinks, I'm a fraud, I can't do it. So this new essay that's just come out yesterday or today in the monthly.
Oh, my God.
Oh yeah. Yeah,
extraordinary. The anxiety that she has been through to write that essay, I can't write it, I need to get this perspective across, how do I get this across? And you think, this is... arguably one of the greatest stylists we have in the country, one of the greatest non-fiction writers or fiction writers. And she's still struggling over a sentence. Does this sentence go too far? And she never lets herself off. She never lets herself off. That's the other thing.
One of the things I really like about the fact that Helen Gardiner is you know, one of our national writers is because I personally don't love all her works equally. I don't love, you know, I mean, so I'm not just sort of a general... I'm quite selective about the ones I read and enjoy. And so, for instance, you know, I mean, I don't want to be heretical, but Jo Cinque didn't work for me at all because I found that very innocence from a, you know, that sort of, well, you know, how could this be that someone could, you know, you'll remember it was about the woman mourning as her son had been convicted, who'd been killed by his girlfriend, and the girlfriend got off basically on grounds of mental disorder, insanity. And this was kind of the whole nub of the book, that Anne Singh, wasn't it? Anne Singh? How could this happen? And I found all that...
the role of justice. It was like...
Yeah, and I just thought, which bit about the plea of insanity, carrying a not guilty verdict, you can then be restrained forever. And it's actually regarded by many as a worse verdict because there's no automatic release at a certain time. Which bit of you, you brilliant Helen Garner, don't you get that you have to keep asking, how could this happen? How could this happen? Well, you know perfectly well how this happens. So I don't like it when she does that. I like her being the brilliant argumenter and the shower of the facets. I don't like it when she actually does that. Who would know this would happen? And I think that's one of the great, great, great things about Garner, because I reckon, and I don't know if you feel this too, but I reckon she... I think it's normal to like certain books more than... because she writes for you at a time. So when you read that book, she's writing to a bit of you, and so different books go and chime with you and turn you on. I mean, when I read The House of Grief, I just almost went and sang hosannas. It was like, it was so brilliantly done. It was so forensic. It was so wise and tragic and beautiful. But as I said, I don't think one has to... I love the fact that she writes a different kind of book. The Spare Room is not the same as The House of Grief.
We're almost at a point where we want to start taking questions, but before we go there, we've focused a lot on the non-fiction, and that's because, so you know, we've got journalists and non-fiction writers on our panel, but let's just use The Spare Room as a bit of an on-ramp to thinking about her fiction. Are there particular fiction books that have stayed with you that you'd like to... bring into this forum to discuss?
It's The Spare Room.
If
you count it as fiction, which it is, I mean, like, she uses her name and obviously draws upon her real life experiences for it, but I actually find that gives it more muscle for some reason to know that she's willing to claim that, yeah, I did feel this. Yes, this something like this happened to me as well. And those, you know, those accounts of, because it's a book about death and grief on one level, or that building sense of grief, but it's really a book about red hot anger.
Rage.
You know, that you have to.
She's so good on rage.
Absolutely. And like, there's that scene. I think I bookmarked it in the book where she basically fantasizes about, like, she is going to drive this woman, like, yeah, she's going to drive them into the river, you know.
Well,
like,
she's going to drive them into a pole. She's
going to
kill
them
into
a pole.
But not herself.
You know,
but there's so much that, there's so many sticky little guy ropes that throw out from this book to her other fiction, because there's this sort of, and it is a female thing, you know, she, part of the rage is the lack of fit between her perceived obligation to be a caring, nurturing person and her desire to be that person, and her deep incomprehension of why it sort of turns into rage without her control. And that kind of ties into all of these questions about, you know, what it is to be a good woman, what it is to be a good mother, what it is to be a caring person, which kind of pitch all the way back to Monkey Grip, I reckon.
Well, even the latest essay that's just come out in the monthly, because I know I was reading it on the train on the way over, you were reading it on the train on the way over as well. And when you talk about with Jo Cinque, that whole question of like, how could this happen? I feel like the monthly piece, when you read it, The thrust of it for me was really, how could it not happen? You know, when you look at what this woman has gone through, she was born in Sudan, she walks through Uganda, she's got kids, and, you know, with every new male relationship, and you get the sense, and it's never quite stated, but obviously culturally coerced relationships as well, and as her responsibilities grow, but her lack of support recedes, It's this horrible ticking time bomb that just leads to this inevitable thing. Like, she explains it step by step, that the unthinkable is so obvious, you know, that there's no other option for her except to just combust. And
she writes so much about... She combusted, but the great mystery was, which was what the book she went to write, actually, which is What Monsters Have We Reared? Because five people, I think it was, five of her fellow students, they knew she was going to poison that Jo Cinque. And why didn't anyone intervene? And that was the book that she went to write, which was the book of what have we wrought, that no one stopped her hand. But, of course, for legal reasons, you couldn't get it. And I said, I don't disrespect the decision she made to take the position of Mrs. Tinkering. I know many people would say it's their favourite books. All I'm saying is I just think it's really important in admiring her not to kind of conflate all the books, because each one has its own issue.
Although there's that common theme of what makes me different from that person who did that, and which is such an important human question that is implicit in all of our, as she puts in this latest essay, you know, reading stories out of the corner of our eye. You know, we read about Robert Farquhar's son or Akun Gwod, I don't know how her name's pronounced, the Sudanese woman who drove into the lake in Melbourne. Our deep internal dialogue with ourselves is about what happened to make that person take that extra step. And I mean, Garner...
And could it happen to me?
Right. Mm. Well, because Garner, I think... In the Farquharson book, this House of Grief talks about coming home and being angry with her grandson and raising a hand to him. And there's that moment where she thinks, well, I have access to this sort of pond of rage inside myself. What is the trigger? What is the release that allows these people to go a step further?
Yeah. I think The Children's Bark is probably a good... like, for me, that question of domesticity and rage and the snaps that happen and the changes that are wrought by, you know, when you leave a domestic space and you move out, Anthea in that that book moves into the affair. That, for me, was a very powerful book, capturing some of those themes, crossing over into fiction.
Very much so.
I know you also revisited Cosmolino recently and sort of had a revamped impression of that novel. Can you talk a bit about that?
Well, that's an interesting one because that was Garner's... the novel that... Well, it's not a novel. It's a collection of stories. We all call it a novel as an easy way, but it's not. It's three stories, which, again, uneven stories. But it's a time in her life when she's deeply, deeply immersed in ideas of mortality. She's reaching her 50th birthday. She's reading the Bibles, three different versions of the Bible. She wants to think about her own spirituality. She wants to think about death. And she's recently taken up with Murray Bale, who is a great man of letters who writes large European-style Australian books, where he has a fundamental belief that any great narrative is based on myth. So all these ideas of big structures, the mythic, the spirituality are coming into play. And she's reading Proust and she's reading Christina Stead. And she's going, oh, my God, this is just so exciting. He's talking about Proust, you know, just blown the tent out and no pegs left and it's all blown away. And then look at this in her journal. Look at this sentence from Christina Stead. And it goes on for, you know, clause after clause. It's grammatically perfect and it's, I can do this. So she goes from being the minimalist perfectionist that she'd done for all those early years in the fiction of saying to people, look, I am a real writer, for those male critics who said she wasn't when she published her diary. And says, bang, I'm going to blow the house apart and I'm going to write this book with these huge baggy sentences exploring angels and people floating off into the air and whatever. And actually, we don't have time to go into it, but in the book I talk about, at the time she was actually going to publish 8 short stories and it became 7 short stories, all to do with the spirit or the soul. Now, that would have changed Garner's reputation if she had published a book about spirit and the soul, which this book is, but people didn't quite get it and they thought, what's going on here? I have to say, my first reading of it way back in 1992, I was a bit like that, sort of, oh, okay, that's a bit strange, that sort of brand Garner has gone. But the beauty of doing this book was immersing yourself in it, and then the most important thing was discovering what was happening in her life at the time and then seeing what she did to put that onto the page. I have a newfound intense respect for that book.
I think that's one of the great things about this book is that it puts all of that material together. We'll have some questions now. So what I'll ask you to do is there's four mics. There's two are up in the circle and there are two in the stalls down here. If you could make your way towards the microphones if you have questions, then I'll be able to see you. But in the meanwhile, I'm going to take one that's just come through from Twitter, the live stream audience. Of course, we've been talking about Ghana with this enthusiast's knowledge of the books, but the question is, what would you recommend as a gateway book for readers who've not yet started with Ghana's works?
Oh,
where do you
question.
Begin?
It's a great and impossible question. Ben, what do you...
I think in fragments, you know, like she often writes in fragments and I like reading her in fragments as well. Like I think her essay collections are really great. Someone's stolen my copy of True Stories. If anyone has it, please give it back. But, you know, the latest collection, I think the first book I read of hers after The First Stone was The Feel of Steel, which has got like, this really strange kind of no-frills black and gold cover here. But, you know, like reading the latest essay collection as well, like you don't have to do it in one hit, but like reading, for instance, the essay about her mum as well, like that just wrecks you in so many... in so many ways. I think come to her in pieces. That's totally fine.
Yeah, that book is just the ideal tasting plate to Ghana, I reckon, because there's longer bits and then there's these great bits that are just five lines long and you just... they're perfect from every angle, like a mold, like a faceted diamond or something. And they're, you know, great to read on a plane too because you just feed yourself little tiny...
Good public transport
bits.
Read, actually.
Though I'd say for people who... I agree, I think, in terms of the sampling, absolutely right, the collections. But, you know, not everyone likes collections. And I would actually say I would encourage people to go right back to Monkey Grip because if you understand that...
Yep.
And that crucible.
Is it a first edition? Show me the cover.
He's got a barrel backstage. I would say that will put you in the mood for
or
everything.
The First Stone you could easily do too.
But I think because it's so contemporary and it's argumentation. Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm the bikini model over here.
Ben's bought the whole library.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll take one question from the side here.
Excuse me. It was such a great question, the first one. I would start with Postcards from Surface.
Oh, yeah.
I would start with that and then Monkey Grip and then The Spare Room.
So. The essay in...
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Not a question, but a contribution.
The essay in Postcards from Surface about her mother and father coming to visit is just one of the greatest pieces of her writing ever. I think it explains so much that you've enlarged upon in your book about this relationship between her mother and her father, which is just, you can see little vapour trails of it everywhere in her writing.
Absolutely central.
Once you know about it, then it is everywhere you look. Yeah. You know, it's...
Are there writers writing today who you see Ghana's legacy operating in? Are there non-fiction writers in the Australian area that in Australian genres?
I think my mate Anna Crean, for instance, like when she goes into her works, and I know that Helen kind of plays a mentoring role in Crean's work as well, but that sense of tackling some pretty heavy stuff and placing yourself in the middle of it all and then doubting yourself every step of the way, I think that's kind of a recurring theme in her works, and you know, you kind of see that tradition being carried on.
I think that in order, like the extent to which she has instilled a culture of doubt in writing is just an intensely valuable thing, because you know, there was a time where to be doubtful was not a great thing, you know, when you...
I think we're still in that age in some ways.
Lee Sales wrote a little book called On Doubt, which is it's a great little book, and I think that that's a valuable gift, and I think that, I mean, I kind of trace it back to Helen Ghana, I think. It's a really valuable thing.
It's really hard to look at fully formed Ghana now in her early 70s with that incredible legacy from, you know, going from those pieces and her work at the Pram Factory and stuff up to now. I don't think anyone can come near it. I mean, it's like who's working like Janet Malcolm today? And well, she's alive, and so as long as Janet Malcolm lives, there need be no second Janet Malcolm. You know, I think we'll only see those people. I mean, I really admire Anna Crean's work, and I mean, there's people, but David Marder's amazing essays and stuff. But I don't think there's anyone who can touch her. For range.
I think that's right. But also in fiction, I think Jennifer Downe, she's a new young writer. Oh, yeah. Her book, Our Magic Hour, which is a great book. But you read that with a kind of Garner lens and you can see a younger generation who may or may not, I haven't asked her whether she was influenced, but you see that influence in that story, very Melbourne story, domestic, comes to Sydney for a bit, goes back to Melbourne. There's traces of Garner there.
Mm. Other questions from the audience? Have we got anyone with a burning... Is there someone shuffling down?
There's a hand here.
There is a hand, but you'll need to come up to this microphone so we can hear you.
Oh.
But here we have one.
But she can't because she's in the middle of a row.
Sorry.
Couldn't we make a dispensation for her?
Yes, in one moment.
We can repeat that question.
Let's hear from this lady here first.
Yeah, so I'll get my confidence here and just do this. So I've just really enjoyed that book, Bernadette. I'm just really interested in... So Janet Malcolm's... fully constructed eye, that sort of paradox between here with dreams of her real self, which I know where that quote's come from, but with her, I think it's her niece, isn't it, or her granddaughter talking about her mother, her grandmother. But so yes, it's constructed, but I certainly feel, especially in her nonfiction, that you get such a feel for her. Is it fully constructed? You know, what? Yes. How would you...
No, it's not fully constructed.
That's a relief.
and so, the emotions, the jumping in, the quick thing, the yanking the girl's hair, that is all Helen Garner, the person who... the person. But Helen Garner, the author who you read on the page, the eye on the page, when you get to see her notebooks or you see how she crafts a sentence, you see how she will change something there and think, oh no, for the narrative to move forward, at this point, I need to be a hell of a lot more fragile. Or for the narrative to move forward here, I'm going to be far more confident, so I change that. And so she changes that around. Now, I'm talking to her one day about one of the scenes in the movie, The Last Days of Shenu. And I'm being very, very correct in saying the character. Oh, the Bill Hunter character, you know, when he walks across the courtyard to the Helen Garner character, the me character, she calls it, in the film, and offers her some water from home. And Helen jumps in. We're sitting at her dining room table. She jumps in and says, oh, yes. And I said, yeah, I don't like that water. I don't want that water. And she says, oh, it's so terrible. And I'm thinking, okay, we've just crossed the boundary here. You've just said I, but it was actually a character, whatever. So, yes, it is very much her, but it's... In what you read, it's a constructed her, so which it has to be because you don't want unfiltered, unthought through I. So the I is put there in a way that is cleverly worked out.
But the extent, just the extent. I mean, you document in this book the extent of her magpie-like borrowings from her own friends' experiences. And there's half a dozen instances where that got super awkward, you know, and... It's
super awkward.
Right. And it's such an interesting piece of the puzzle, isn't it, that she is, you know, been through analysis and therapy to be incredibly self-aware but is also such a technician as a writer that she can dispassionately dial that stuff up and down for the purposes of the structure of whatever she's writing, you know. There's a certain, like there's a real... Coldness is the wrong word.
No, it's a ruthlessness. Yeah. It's a rigorousness. And Tsolkas says the same thing. Christos Tsolkas says, if you're a writer, that's what you do. You feed off what you know, your other people's things, and no apologies. This is what you do.
Well, she eventually issued an apology to Axel Clark, didn't she? But, I mean, that was outrageous as well.
It was pretty big.
fill them in.
Maybe reading the book would fill them in.
It's too big to fill in. It's a good story.
We'll take one more question before. And perhaps, I'll repeat it so the live audience can hear. So the question was about her courage to expose her personal life with particular reference to The Last Days of Shenu.
Yes, and so the lady in the audience had said that the screenplay was based on the fact that Garner's younger sister... ended up marrying Garner's second husband. And that's true. And the interesting thing is a lot of people don't know that. And that means that the film, I think, and the screenplay stand on their own as a piece of theatre and as a screenplay, which is very interesting. What do I know about that? I don't want to say too much about that. I do want to say, and I say the bits in the book which are really interesting, which is when Helen's writing the screenplay for that and what she was wanting it to be, and it didn't quite have the kind of tone that she was hoping. She was hoping that it was more of a bit of a gay farce or whatever that went on in a kind of Chekhovian way. But yes, this happens in her life. And again, like so much that happens in her life, she has to write about it. She needs to make sense of it. And so how does she write about it? And I argue in the book that I think, probably unbeknownst to herself, she writes about it as a screenplay over which she cannot have complete control. Because if she was to write about it where she is a simple author, every word she has to take control of or responsibility for. And so she does make this film. And she was very grateful that at the Berlin Film Festival it went down very well with an audience that knew nothing about her life. And as she says, they laughed in all the right places. And that's really important to her. But so, yes, it was very intimate and about her life and her family, all of whom are still living and still having those relationships. And yet it was also a piece of the film for other people to enjoy, which kind of gets to the nub of what it is about Garner and how she writes, that so much of it is informed by her life, by her experiences, what she knows, by the very close relationships in her life. But arguably, because she's so popular and so well-read, she obviously takes it to a new level where it means something to all of us that don't have that exact life, but understand those relationships, those dilemmas, those ethical problems, those sorts of things.
That connection to the reader. Okay. Bernadette's going to be signing books after this in the Ruth Cracknell room directly after this session, so you can go and have a chat to her and get a signature on your book. But if you'd like to join with me in thanking our guests for a really dynamic conversation today. Thank you to Ben, to Jennifer, Annabelle, Bernadette.